swirling and tumbling in on one another, creating whirlpools 100 yards across. Michael spun quickly on his heels and began to head in the westerly direction taken by Ryan and the others. The unexpected stillness caught Ryan, leading the rest of the group at a dead run, across the open ground that lay between the ruins of the Institute and where he figured the front line of the remaining pirates had to be. The sand began to settle and the air cleared, though there was still a bone-deep rumbling, some limitless distance far below their sprinting feet. It was as though a curtain had been pulled back in the middle of a scene out of a play, with all of the actors frozen in their places. Scattered among the dunes, most of the surviving pirates were standing upright, shocked from hiding by the abrupt horror of the big quake. Moving fast, reflexes trained to a razor's edge, Ryan and the others had an enormous advantage over the startled group of killers. JD was first, shooting his Uzi from a crouch, pouring a stream of bullets into the hills of sand and scrub. Ryan took his time, firing all 9 remaining rounds from the Steyr, picking his targets, most at a range of less than 50 yards, killing 6, wounding 2, and missing 1. Around him, he was conscious of the boom of the Browning, the sharper sound of Christie's double-action Smith & Wesson, and the measured snap of Mildred's ZKR 551, each bullet killing another pirate. Ryan glanced behind him, wondering what had happened to Michael, and saw him running flat out, his little .38 gripped in his right fist. It was an absolute and shattering victory. There was barely a single round fired in retaliation from the shattered gang. 2 or 3 raised their hands in a token of surrender. While the others consolidated the area, Ryan ran on alone, aware that none of the corpses had been dressed in red, aware that the last of the wags had to be somewhere over the crest of the hill. Less than 30 seconds after it ceased, the quake returned, with redoubled vigor. Ryan was lifted off his feet and hurled sideways, the empty rifle nearly slipping from his shoulders. If it hadn't been among soft sand, the rolling fall could easily have left him with a broken shoulder or ribs. But he managed to get up quickly, though the unbelievable violence of the earthquake had shaken him to the very core. Once again, the air was filled with dust, and Ryan blinked his one good eye, struggling to see what was happening. He stood on the highest point of the quay, with the ocean visible on both sides. But it was hardly recognizable. The Gulf and the Atlantic, both dappled with a shimmering layer of white foam. To his right, Ryan glimpsed the Institute, a few figures scurrying about in the ruins, like tiny ants whose home had been disturbed by a careless spade. A little farther down the hollow, near the dry creek, stood Christie, JB, and the others, all fighting for balance. Even as he watched, Ryan saw Doc clutch at Mildred's arm for support. To the left was the undulating length of the highway, its blacktop obscured by drifting sand. Less than 100 yards away was the remaining Armawag, and halfway toward it, crawling on hands and knees, was a figure in bright red shirt and pants. Jack Yeovil's back was turned, and Ryan realized immediately that the noise of the quake would drown out any noise he might make in closing with the pirate's leader. It crossed his mind to stop and reload the Steyr, but that would take a few precious seconds, and with the quake making the land writhe like a broken-backed rattler, it could be a difficult shot, allowing Yeovil to make it to the relative safety of the small Armawag. For Ryan Cotter, to think was to act. He moved as quickly as he could, balancing like someone on a slack wire, closing the gap between himself and Yeovil. He drew the Ponga from its sheath as he ran down the slope. At the last moment, the man sensed him coming and half-turned, fumbling for a slate-gray automatic in his broad leather belt. Ryan had a momentary impression of a narrow, foxy face with long, dyed red hair and curling side whiskers tinted with white, a mouth opening in a snarl of bitter, defeated hatred, and eyes of the palest blue staring fixedly up at approaching death. Yeovil made one last, desperate attempt to parry what he guessed would be a powerful hacking blow aimed at taking the head from his shoulders, but he guessed wrong. Ryan changed the angle of the Ponga, using it with the probing delicacy of a surgeon instead of the clumsy brutality of the slaughterer. He dove in, turning in the air, jabbing down with the 18-inch blade, aiming for the exposed angle of Yeovil's throat below his left ear. The honed steel whispered through skin and flesh, slicing open the walls of the artery. Bright crimson fountained into the quivering earth, dripping all over the scarlet shirt and pants. Ryan was on his feet, beckoning to the others to hurry and join him. The earthquake was worsening, and the stench of the undersea eruption was becoming overpowering.
I believe that the time has come to depart!
Nobody argued with Doc. The weather changed the same day that Abrek and the Cougar meat would run out. He'd skinned and gutted the monster, throwing the tripe a few yards from the cabin door, smearing the fresh snow with black gobbets. The good meat he tied up to the rafters of the cabin, where he took it down and cooked it over a small fire, a fire that ceased to burn on the fifth day, due to the lack of fuel. After that, Abe devoured the meat raw, washing it down with snow crystals. The skin and offal from the cougar had vanished in the first night, and he was careful to block the broken window so that no other creature would take him by surprise. Now the temperature outside had risen by 20 degrees since the bleak dawning, and a warm wind blew from the west, tasting of the ocean that lay in that direction. The roof ran with meltwater, and the trees all around were dripping noisily, pitting the graying snow beneath their branches. For the first time in an age, Abe was able to walk a few cautious, hesitant steps outside, taking in deep breaths of the clammy, thick air.
Sure tastes green.
The line shack behind him was cramped and dirty, smelling of blood, shit, and darkness. It was a relief for Abe to be out and on the trail again, moving the last miles toward the Pacific. He traveled less than a mile when he smelled wood smoke and what was very much like the scent of baked apples with cinnamon sauce. The stainless steel Colt Python was in his gloved fist without his even realizing that he'd drawn it. The smell of food meant people. People could be good news or bad news. Abe picked his way carefully through the melting slush, hearing a stream somewhere below the trail, already roaring with the swelling water that was coursing down from the mountains all around. The path was slippery and treacherous, with pockets of glazed ice and wet snow overlaying each other. As he worked his way lower, the wind changed a little, veering easterly, and the warm smell of cooking vanished. Abe stopped, aware of the damp already penetrating his worn combat boots, trickles from the pines finding their way beneath the collar of his coat.
Oh, do you remember Sweet Betsy from Pack? She crossed the big mountains with her lover, Ack, with 2 yoke of oxen and a big yellow dog, and a tall Shanghai rooster, and 1 spotted hog.
Abe still kept his blaster ready, but he felt little sense of immediate danger.
Someone there? Yo, the camp!
Abe spotted a thin trickle of light gray smoke filtering up through the trees ahead of him. The smell of the apples was stronger, making him salivate with sharp hunger.
Come ahead! You on your own?
Yeah, you?
Sure am! Wouldn't be exercising my mule skinner's bray like that if I'd known there was anyone close.
Abe holstered the .357 Magnum. It was rarely a good idea to enter someone else's camp with your blaster drawn and cocked. Now he could see the owner of the questionable singing voice. The man was around 6 feet tall, wrapped in so many layers of ragged furs and clothes that it was impossible to tell if he weighed 120 or 250. He had on a balaclava helmet made from dark blue wool that covered all of his face except for his mouth and a pair of bright green eyes. A rope belt was knotted around his midriff, with what looked like an antique Colt Navy cap and ball pistol with broken grip stuck into it.
Come ahead, friend. Just baking me some apples I found in a barn a couple of weeks back before the snows came closing in on me.
Smells good.
I'm Floyd. Floyd Thirsty.
My name's
Abe, if I don't miss my bone-cracking guess. Yeah, you'd be Abe.
How'd you know that?
You're as lean as a whipcord, and you got a mustache. He said he couldn't understand why you bothered to cultivate something so downright ugly under your nose when you got plenty more hair than that growing wild round your ass. Only sort of joke the old guy made, if it was supposed to be a joke.
Traitor.
He called himself that. Carried an armalite so old it looked like Noah himself used it to blast the dove out of the sky. He left a letter for you, Abe.
Letter?
Sure. Wait a minute.
Now wait just a damn minute. Traitor couldn't fucking write.
Correct. But I can. Next question is, can you read, Abe?
Sure. Got taught by a breed woman out near Sonora. Got a knife in my thigh and a sort of disagreement in a gaudy. She looked after me. Fed me shit-tasting soup and taught me my letters. I don't know which one was worse.
Well, here it is.
How did he know I was around these parts, Floyd? How could he know?
The man grinned through the damp slit in his woolen hood.
You know him. Does that answer the question? Yeah,